So today what I'm going to talk about is actually a purely KIGP product. It started here just 2.5 months ago, and I really thank all the organizers and participants for all the discussions, and especially I would like to thank a few people with whom I discussed all this stuff I'm talking about, especially Vijay Kumar, who's in the audience, Naveel Iqbal, and Max Metlisky, also Professor Leon Belens and Sir Joe Polchinski. So what I'm going to discuss today is the following question. Suppose I give you some strongly correlated theory of, Lorentz invariance theory, and I'm interested in some general structure of the phase diagram. How does the phase diagram look like? Are there some constraints on this theory which come from some general principle? So it turns out recently there has been lot of progress in this question, these three papers especially, and I'm trying to use some of these results derived by other people to see, can I say something about conjugate systems which people are interested in. And what is the import of these things is, so let me write down just a brief outline of my talk. So this part is what is there in those papers, those three papers. None of it is mine, this part. And second, but I will be trying to relate that to condensed matter. And so perhaps many of you have heard about this theorem called C theorem. It's a theorem for 1+1-dimensional CFTs. And what it says is that there exists a number which you can define at every CFT fixed point. It's called central charge C, and it always it has a particular direction along RG flow. So if you have one fixed point here, and you have another fixed point here, and if you're suppose this is the RG flow. Now I've not put the arrow here, which direction I'm going. Suppose I know here it is C1, central charge, here it is C2. And suppose someone tells you that they know that there is no fixed point in between, and you know that C1 is greater than C2 because you just go here and measure it. Turns out the only way arrow is, this is the only possibility. So central charge decreases from one fixed point to another if you go along RG flow. Let me call this UV point. This is like IR point.
And in between, your theory doesn't have to be conformal, or?
I think it. Conform invariance is defined at a fixed point. So if you're perturbing a system, in between it's not conformal.
Okay, so in between it's not conformal.
Yeah, I don't think so. So it's very helpful, this theorem. For example, suppose I give you a transverse field, not transverse fieldizing model. Suppose I give you a...
It is strictly greater, or is it greater than or equal?
That I don't know, actually. I think it's... Maybe someone knows here. I don't know.
Marginal direction.
Could be equal to.
Could be equal, I think.
An RG file.
But all the cases I'm discussing, it's obvious. But it's, maybe it is. Maybe it just is. It's perfectly marginal. I think, yeah, if you have perfectly marginal directions, then it's allowed to.
It's marginal.
Then if you have the C1 is larger than C2, what's the inverse relation between the C1 and C2?
Right, so I'm assuming there's nothing in between right now.
Nothing in between.
Right, in fact, that's a very useful thing. For example, I will give you two examples where it is very useful. Suppose you have some fixed point here and a fixed point here. And suppose here it is C1 and here it is C2. And suppose perturbatively you can calculate RG flow, and you know it looks like this. And you also know that suppose C1 is less than C2. So then you know that something in between is going to happen. For example, there could be a extra phase transition here. So it means that something in between has to happen if C1 is less than 0. So this way you can predict phase transitions sometimes, if you know the up, because this is some perturbative calculation you did here. So that can be done. Also here you did some perturbative calculation. Even though this was this and this was this, there's no direct flow because of this. And another example is if you take your tricritical Ising point in 1 plus 1D, and it has central charge 7/10. So suppose this is your tricriticalizing point. And then you add some relevant perturbation here. This is central charge 7/10. So what can happen? Suppose it goes to some other fixed point, which is CFT. It turns out there are only two possibilities because of central charge theorem. Because there are only two unitary CFTs which have central charge less than 7/10. One is central charge 0, other is central charge 1/2. So this way, it's very restrictive. Nothing much can happen. So this was actually a very classic example which was used in early days of the C theorem. So this C theorem actually I should mention, I'm sure everyone knows this, but it's from Zamolodchikov. Make sure I get the spelling correct. So it's an obvious question to ask what is the generalization of this to higher dimensions, because it's so useful in 1 plus 1D. So it turns out in 3 plus 1D, there was a Kadi had a conjecture in 1988, which generalizes to 3 plus 1D. It turns out in higher dimension there are more number of central charges, but there's one particular central charge which turned out to have similar properties. It's called A theorem now. It's not just A theorem, it's A theorem. It's very useful. So let me just mention it. So it was more like a conjecture for some years, but recently there has been a rigorous proof I can mention this. So there's a And there was an earlier work by Osborne and Jack, also in late 1980s, which tried to give almost a proof, but not quite. So this was the more recent work, which is a recurse proof. So this is 1 plus 1D, this is 3 plus 1D. But now, as you saw, if you were in this conference, most things are not in these dimensions. Most things we are talking about are in 2 plus 1D. In condensed matter, at least for somehow in this conference. I don't know why, but it's just true. It's just this fact. So the question is there something in that? So that's where those guys come in, and they recently, there's been a lot of work in this direction. And So I will let me summarize some of the statements, and I'm not an expert in this. I'm just trying to understand those papers, and what has been found is this: if you have a CFD and you put it on S3. So you put it on S3, just it's a very simple, one of the simplest manifold in this compact and in three-dimensional, and then you calculate its free energy and look at the constant part of free energy. Free energy will have many terms. So free energy, let me call it just F prime, will have many terms. It's like L cubed and L square and L, all these terms are allowed, but there's a constant part. Let me call it just F. And this constant part is supposed to be analog of this central charge. So all these things have cutoff dependence, these things. So defines a non-dimensional number, like, I don't know, beta f or something, if you like. But this does not have any, this because it's a constant, it doesn't have length dependence, there's a possibility of it being universal. So long ago, if you go back in 1990s, we were thinking of free energy itself as central charge long ago, but turns out that was not correct. But this free energy on S3 turned out to be, it's not a proof. It has been, it's still a somewhat of a conjecture for non-supersymmetric theories which don't have holographic dual, but theories which have, for a very large class of theories, there's a proof that this works. For all theories, there's a perturbative proof that if you sit at a fixed point and go slightly away, this thing decreases under RG. So that's, I think, the third paper there. So there's a lot of evidence, and you can check for any model that you have recently worked on, say ON model or QED3 or gauge series coupled with anything. In large and limit, people have checked it works. So there is no counterproof, and there's a lot of evidence. And then there's a totally different direction people have gone into, which is, so here you saw central charge appears. So central charge, where does central charge appear? Somewhere in some other quantity. It's entanglement entropy in 1 plus 1b. So we know that the universal part of entanglement entropy, the coefficient is central charge in 1 plus 1b. So it turns out here there is another formulation of this whole thing, which is you don't have to do this somewhat more exotic thing of putting things on S3. Just take your ground state wave function, calculate its entanglement entropy for a circle of say radius r. So this is entanglement entropy formulation of this. So you calculate S for radius r. It is some alpha r minus some gamma plus order 1 over r and so on. So again, this alpha is non-universal because it has some cutoff dependence here. But this gamma has the potential of being universal. And as we know from our condensed matter experience, this is actually universal. I mean, we use it all the time. This is a universal constant. And there's a reason for it, because there's no cutoff dependence here. So it is known that this is universal, but the question is, does it have any nice feature? It turns out that it is also an log of central charge. It decreases under, if you go from one CFT to another, that's what, there's a attempted proof. I don't know whether how rigorous it is. It's possible it's fully rigorous, but since I don't understand the full paper, the second paper, it is for general theories which are Lorentz invariants. It doesn't even assume confirmed invariants. Fixed point should be just Lorentz invariants. And so if you go from one fixed point to another, the claim is that this gamma 1, gamma 2 is less than gamma 1 for Lorentz invariants here. And Lorentz invariant series doesn't have to be confirmed invariants, I think. And you can ask, okay, there are two formulations, what's going on? Turns out you can prove for all CFTs, this number F is the same gamma. So that is known. So they are actually related. In fact, in lower dimensions also, if you go, here central charge, and you can put systems on, say, rather than, so if you are in 1 plus 1D CFT, you can put system on a sphere, for example, for S2. It turns out, again, central charge shows up. So always seems like there's a relation between free energy is on SD and some quantity which is related to entanglement. So there's no real, I mean, there's already known that there are such examples in other dimensions of relations. So given this, so what I'm going to do now is to assume that is correct and ask what are the consequences for condensed matter. So let me start with the simplest example of a model which was discussed in the last talk. It is the Kitaev model, honeycomb model. So as you know that Kitaev honeycomb model has many faces, but if you sit at the isotropic fixed point, which is all the couplings are same, then you get this Dirac Z2 spin liquid. So it has a Z2 gauge field coupled to Meyeringer fermions. And so it has some low energy theories. Essentially, you can think of it as a one Dirac fermion, because it's two Meyerners, you can combine them to form one Dirac. So it's essentially, the content is essentially this. Plus Z2 gauge field. This is coupled to it, so it's some sigma is a Z2 gauge field. So I mean, in the lattice, it looks like eta i j, the Meyeringer fermions. This is a Hamiltonian essentially. We can add a gauge field. At least it's allowed.
In the top line, does psi have two or four components?
Sorry?
Does psi have two or four components?
Right now it has two components. Soon it will become four in a different problem. But here it is two. So it is known that if you add a small magnetic field in the 111 direction, in fact, infinitesimal magnetic field, this spin liquid is unstable to a non-abelian spin liquid. So this is in the original Kitaev's paper. So let's see how it works, this theorem there. So here is my Kitaev gapless spin liquid. And then you add a magnetic field, and it goes to something which is non-abelian topological base. So this is a Dirac, this free fermion, because you can just solve it. So it turns out the gamma value for Dirac is, I can write down this value, which is important for me many times. So gamma value for Dirac, I call it D, is 0.2190, approximately. And gamma value for a scalar, a real scalar, is 0.063. So suppose I forget about the gauge fluctuations completely. Suppose I think of it just as a Dirac fermion. Then I know here gamma is, say, 0.22 essentially. And for this topological phase, I know the gamma from, because this gamma for all gap phases is the same as topological entanglement entropy. Because topological entanglement entropy is exactly this. You calculate entanglement for a region, and all topological field theories are, by definition, conformally invariant, and they have all symmetry. Hamiltonian is zero. So in the low energy theory, all these things work. There's no, it has more symmetry than, in fact, a conformal field theory. So this for gamma for a topological phase is the same as gamma topological entanglement entropy. So here you can calculate it, it's known answer, it's actually log 2. Because it has I won't derive its one line result, square root of 4, it's 2, and, sorry. I already did that, sorry. I promise not to, but, So, 0.69. So clearly this flow is not allowed. you will think. If it were a Dirac fermion, it can't go here. But there's a missing ingredient that I did not take into account. There's a gauge fluctuation. In fact, there's a paper by Hong Yao and Xiaoliang Qi where they calculate does the entanglement entropy for this for a circle, and it's exactly h plus log. That's the full answer. So it's allowed. That's the reason. So if you by mistake you forgot about the gauge fluctuations, if you think of it just like a Dirac fermion without any gauge field coupled to it, you'll get a wrong answer of 0.22, but the exact answer is 0.22 plus log 2. So it tells you that even when things are kind of almost decoupled in the low energy, this Dirac fermion at the Kitai point is essentially decoupled with the gauge theory. But even then you have to be careful in taking into account the gauge fluctuations or the fact that there is extra degrees of freedom. So it's allowed because of, otherwise it will violate that. And let's take one other example before I do more interesting things. So let's consider just your something like graphene, for example. So if you have a graphene, then we know that it has a U4 symmetry. It has four, at a non-interacting fixed point, graphene has some, it has four different kind of orbital spin and valley. So it has four indices. So you have some U4 symmetry, for example. And then you can ask the question, is it possible that graphene has a direct RG flow to some symmetry broken phase which has Boltzmann modes? Is it allowed? Is this a possibility? This is, in some sense, a silly example because we know the answer. We know this is not allowed. In fact, there is a finite coupling phase transition. Actual thing is like this. It's a stable phase, this phase transition. But let me rule out this based on this theorem. So let me be very generous and allow full symmetry breaking. U4 down to say zero. Here they are. At least SC4, I think, so it has 15 Boltzmann modes. Because 4 squared minus 1 is 15. So here, let's calculate. There are four Dirac fermions, two component. So each two component Dirac fermion contribute that. See, you calculate it, it's essentially 0.88. Here it is actually 0.90, essentially. So this was not allowed. So somehow the fact.
Sorry, so here assume that the full SU4.
Right. So that's the point. This theorem doesn't tell you what happened. It rules out things. It's not that if something is greater than something else, there will be always a flow.
So
it's not
saying that the symmetry of SU4 cannot be entirely broken.
Yeah. We know the actual answer. It can't be even partially broken. But that's a separate point. I'm just saying that there's an interesting consistency check of the theorem. If you, for example, if break SU4 down to SU2, theorem won't have any interesting thing to say about it. It says maybe it can occur, maybe it can't occur. But so it's a theorem about what can't happen rather than what can happen, like central charge theorem in 2D. So that's why I said it's a silly example.
You don't know the second one is the right one or.
Yeah. But I'm saying that at least we know that this can't happen. I'm just saying that this is the actual answer known from some other analysis.
So you just multiply 15 times
0.06. So there is a with subtlety. When you have a Goldstone mode, you have to be careful how you calculate this number. So the way, in my opinion, the right way to do is to add a small mass to Goldstone mode, then take thermodynamic limit, and then take m to 0. That's how we think about symmetry breaking also. You first take thermodynamic limit, then take mass to 0. If you do that, then you find that answer. If you don't add mass and put m is equal to 0, you get all kinds of things. You can get logs, for example.
Yeah,
but
right.
So that will as max.
Right.
So So far so good. So let me ask somewhat a non-trivial application. So suppose tomorrow someone does some DMRG and they find a phase diagram which looks like this. And it turns out there are many cases where it has been done and it turns out to be like this. So you do something, you know there's a nail order here. It turns out this case is topologically ordered. So those in the audience who has not heard this word topological order, it just means that no one has it here is a topological quantum field theory. So then in two dimensions there is this whole classification of topological order. I don't know whether it's complete or not, but what we know so far is that there is a large class of things which come into this, for example, discrete gauge theories or quantum Hall states or the whole string net, for example. So the question is, what is the nature of this phase transition between a nail order and topological ordered phase? So obviously I can't tell the answer to that, but I can rule out things based on this. So if it's a nail ordered phase, to say usual paramagnet, just conventional paramagnet, it has SC2 symmetry here, you will think that the phase transition is just O3. That's a nice guess. It has that's a symmetry, so you will think if you break it, it will be just O3 Wilson Fischer fixed point. Question is, is it here? Also, we know from various theories built on slave particle and whatnot, all those things tell you actually it's not most of the time. But can I rigorously show that it can never happen? So I'll show you now that this transition can never be O3, if you assume that conjecture or theorem, I don't know. So the way to see this is that, so suppose it is, assume this is O3, Wilson Fischer fixed point, I will reach a contradiction. And contradiction is this. So you suppose this is O3, Wilson Fischer fixed point, you can reach it from a flow down from a Gaussian fixed point. So this is just what you learned in your StatMac course, that you can, this is a Gaussian fixed point which is unstable to O3. So then you can put a bound on gamma of O3. So gamma of O3 must be less than 3 into 0.06, roughly, like 0.18. So if this is 0.18, the topological phase better has something which is less than 0.18. It turns out there is no topological phase which satisfies the condition. Forget about what we are talking, Z2 spin liquid, for example. Z2 spin liquid is very large. It's log 2, which is 0.69. But take the simplest topological phase, which has quantum dimension just 2. So it is log of square root 2, which is log plane 1/2 state. So gamma for, say, mu is equal to 1/2 is this. And this is 3.46, something like this. So clearly, even that can't happen. So this tells you that any phase transition of such kind can never be in the conventional universality class. And that is what is found in various, if you do actual theory, but suppose I didn't even have a slave particle, that's some formalism you're using, but if there's already a theorem, then you don't have to, at least you can rule out something. So far so good. And you can do similar thing for bosons instead of O3 models. Suppose you have superfluid to Laughlin transition. So there is some work by Mason recently where they studied such things. I think they studied phase transition between mu is equal to 1/2 to superfluid. So again, you can argue using similar arguments that it can never be a XY transition of the usual kind. What else can you do with that transition is that, for example, if it's an integer quantum Hall of bosons, suppose, consider this scenario. This is integer quantum Hall of bosons. This is recently discussed SPT stuff, which people are talking about. And suppose this is your superfluid. So we know that this is an integer quantum Hall, it has gamma is equal to 0. So now there is no constraint. So it's allowed to be xy. It turns out it is xy. So it's again consistent. So exactly when this was allowed, it happened actually in this case. If it were some fraction quantum Hall of bosons, it's not allowed, and so it's all consistent with what you think. So let me go to the next thing, which I think is somewhat more interesting. So let me ask questions about these algebraic spin liquids, say Kagome lattice or various things which...
I'm just going to have a really simple question. Is there some just easy intuitive picture why gamma should go down? Is it just like things get more trivial or something as you...
I don't have a very good answer, but I think it's a measure of entanglement. So when you do RG, entanglement always decreases. And this is the only universal measurement because it doesn't have any cutoff dependence. The way to think about C theorem is that you have C log L, and it goes down under RG. It goes from C prime log L to C prime less than C. So same way, things become less entangled under RG, less expectation. So that was kind of, so if you are going from some gapless point to some gapped point which is topological order, it seems like a very hard thing to do because you are starting with some, maybe it has gaplessness, but it has a lot of stuff, but it may not have enough stuff to go to some highly entangled state under RG. And that's what is going on in this. So generally in 1+1D this doesn't occur because central charge zero is just central charge zero. It's just fully gapped state, there's no constraint. There's only one featureless state. But in higher dimensions, even if it's something fully gapped, it can have a lot of stuff because wave function is sum of many, many things and it's hard to reach there.
So does it mean that the RG flow can never be cycloic?
That I don't know. I think there are people who have studied these things more, much more than, I mean, I've read those people.
About the cyclic flow of the Riemannian group.
I don't know in this three dimensions. Maybe you should ask Vijay. I think he knows it.
I think in 1+1 dimensions it can't happen.
Because there's a C. Yeah, there's a C function in 1+1D.
Yeah. Yeah, but 2+1D, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think no one has derived. So in 1+1D, there's more than C theorem. There's a whole C function you can define as a function of couplings, and its fixed point value is this center charge C of CFT. But here I don't have any function in between. I'm just telling one fixed point and that fixed point. So
in a sense, it's a weaker statement.
Yeah, definitely. Weaker than C theorem so far.
But actually, if you do a field redefinition that depends on the energy scale, then you can sort of trivially introduce cyclic behavior. Just because your field redefinition depends on the normalization scale.
So let me study this algebraic spin liquids next. So these are they arise all the time, at least in theory land. These objects. So and the no energy theory of these algebraic spin liquids looks like basically QED3. So it's some Dirac fermion of NF flavors, suppose. So the question is, what are the instabilities of this theory? It's often asked question, how stable it is, to confinement, to symmetry breaking. They're very often asked question, and people expect when the number of flavors is large enough, then things are okay. But is there some critical number you can put where instabilities go away? So I think that has been lagging, and so I will attempt to put some bounds on critical number required using this theorem now. So I don't know how much time I have. I will take 5 more minutes. So let me first ask stability to to spontaneous symmetry breaking of continuous symmetry. So it turns out people have studied this question since 1980s. It's called this whole symmetry breaking when you break this continuous UNF symmetry, the UNF symmetry here, that is called chiral symmetry breaking. And the reason is because there is no chirality actually here. This is 2 plus 1D. There is no notion of chirality in Dirac matrices. They're defined only in even spatial dimensions. But chiral symmetry is actually defined once you know what is chiral symmetry breaking. So there is a symmetry breaking pattern that is called chiral symmetry breaking. And that is corresponds to UNF over 2 times UNF over 2. So there is a lot of work in this showing that this is the most likely pattern of symmetry breaking. So I will assume that. And there is a theorem by Wafa and Witten which tries to give arguments that this is the only channel in which it happens, if it happens. So the best way to define this, work with this is to actually multiply everything by 2 here. And work with 2NF, two component flavors. And you can organize them in this way. So you write, define a four component object, psi up, psi down. So psi up and psi down both are two component. And the mass, if you give opposite mass term to psi up and psi down. So there is a flavor index here, A. A runs from 1 to NF. So forget about, so this is actually 2NF then, in this case. So they are 2NF, two component, which is same as four component NF. And if you give opposite mass to up and down, that's called chiral symmetry breaking. Because it is opposite mass term, it does not generate any Chern-Simons term, it just cancels out. So it's some symmetry breaking pattern, which is seen in numerics, lattice, QED, and all kind of calculations. And we will have confirmed this is how it happens. So, but it is known that there is a critical NF above which it does not happen. It is stable to, it remains in this deconfined phase because this is like confinement accompanied by symmetry breaking, this chiral symmetry breaking. So let me put a bound on when it won't happen. I can derive an NF above which it will not happen. It cannot happen even below that, but at least above that it won't happen. So assuming that this thing holds. So the idea is this, that you suppose it was stable to chiral symmetry breaking. So let's try to understand what is the RG flow looks like. You have some UV fixed point, and I assume that the way to reach this interacting QED3, which is deconfining, is start with say massless fermions and gauge bosons here. And so you can think of it like an N-log of Gaussian fixed point is like Wiechert fixed point. So everything here is free. Here things are interacting. And at some point of NF, it further goes symmetry breaking to some Goldstone mode phase. So I don't know anything about this point because it's interacting. You can do large NF, which is useful actually in this case, but let me not do that right now. Let me try to put something more exact. So Goldstone mode phase. And then if flow is like this, gamma value here should be greater than here. Now here, it scales like NF, because there are NF fermions, and there's a one photon, which you have to treat very carefully again, because you can get logs actually with photon. But again, if you think in the dual language, photon as a Goldstone mode, give it a large confinement length, and then take confinement length to infinity. If you do that calculation, it's same as Goldstone mode. So I assign it as a scalar. So it is some NF fermions plus photon. And I'm dealing right now with non-compact one. You can deal with compact, doesn't matter. There'll be one extra degree of freedom here. If it's a compact QED, then there'll be only 2NF square Goldstone mode here. You can do the counting from this symmetry breaking pattern. Plus or not a photon. So there'll be photon depending on whether it's a compact or not. It doesn't change answer much. Depends on your theory. If there's a compact QED, it will gap out this photon in the final because there are no fermions left. If it's a non-compact, it will survive. So let's consider a non-compact case. So clearly you see the scaling is different. Here it is nf, here it is n square f. So when nf is very large, it can't happen. And that from there you get the bound. So this can't happen when there are nf 4 component. Again, this is notation I use. So nf into 2 into gamma Dirac plus gamma photon must be bigger than 2nf square. You can put greater than equal if you like, doesn't really matter those things. So because it is having a bound, so plus some gamma photon. So I assign gamma photon same as gamma ghost from mode by duality, and then I call pretty equal to basically a scalar. So you can just cancel out actually here into gamma scalar. So I get some answer which is ratio of these two universal numbers. So this is symmetry breaking is allowed only if this condition is satisfied. I think this is some 3.3 or I don't remember, something around 3.4. So if NF is bigger than this number, this possibility is ruled out, this particular symmetry breaking.
Can you remind me what your factor of two convention is? So this means
yes. So
Dirac fermions?
They are two NF, two component Dirac fermions, or say which is same as NF, four component Dirac fermions. This is 2NF. So this, let me call this I, to not to confuse with I here. So these are 2NF, two component. I can write them as NF, four component by defining in this way.
What would this NF be for, say, the Dirac spin equivalent?
It depends on which Dirac spin. So there are people who have studied all kinds of examples. So the one...
The spin model one, say?
Right, spin model is also NF depends on the lattice.
Or Kagome, say?
Yeah, Kagome, I think. Right, so in that case it turns out to be...
The triangles and
in that case it turns out to be not useful, in the Kagome one. In that case, there... Patrick, remember, I think two component there, NF is 4, so 4 component is 2. So it's allowed to break symmetry, so it doesn't tell you it happens. But there's a paper by Matthew and I don't remember all of them, sorry. But there, it is actually bigger than this. It is 8. It is 8 two component one, which is 4 four component one. So, yeah. I can tell the difference. Mm-hmm. So they actually, I noted down four examples which I found where they were, number was bigger than this. So they are okay to this symmetry breaking, but other things can go wrong. For example, it can confine with full gap. So that was there's a second part. I can rule that out also using some other work of Kliap should put that reference. Same work by Wafa and Witten, which rules out full gap. So then you can put a bound so that above which deconfinement occurs. I don't know whether I should go into it. That was my last example, but I think it's probably, people got the flavor, so I don't have to input that reference. So.
In the reference for this thing?
This is a reference where with this reference, this added power, you can derive on deconfinement.
Yeah, is a reference for what you are telling us?
So there's a paper I wrote which you'll be going to deny on archive. So,
okay.
Sorry, but most of it is I'm using other people's words. So these are things interesting papers to look at. So. we should write a Ryle-Yuxel for the kind of questions I was supposed to tell after this. They basically rule out, so if you combine this result of not having Goldstone modes with some of the results in that paper, you can even rule out confinement because of monopoles or those kind of things. So that was again, I can. So basic idea is that there's a theorem by Rafa Witten which tells you that if the number of flavors of fermion is bigger than certain critical number, then there must be gapless particles in the spectrum. So the full statement is, if you start with the massless fermions and photons in the UV, there must exist gapless objects, they can be anything, in the IR, if the number of flavors of fermions is bigger than certain critical number. So that is the paper. So now if you combine this with what I'm trying to derive here, for a certain number of flavors bigger than that, I can rule out Goldstone modes. So the only other possibility left for the kind of things we are interested in is deconfinement. So if you combine that with entanglement monotonicity, then you can derive a bound above which you definitely expect deconfinement. It can occur even below that, but I'm putting a upper bound on.
Yeah. So what is that upper bound? Just a little curious.
Sorry?
What's the actual number?
It's actually 4. So in this QED case, if NF is greater than or equal to 4, so that number is 3, I think. I mean, greater than 3, I think. I think for NF is equal to 3 might be also fine. But since I'm getting 3.4, it doesn't help to have that. So NF greater than or equal to 4, 4 component ones. These are 4 component. So it is same as 8 component, 8 2 component ones. You can even rule out deconfinement. So some of the papers which people have worked out recently, they were actually worked by Assad on square lattice biflux, where they have, I think, 8 2-component fermions. So there was a lot of question whether it is stable or not. But to me, it seems like there's a non-perturbative argument. So if this theorem is really there, then there's no approximation. It's an exact thing. So and then you can all generalize this to QCD, for example, which is non-abelian theory. You can't do much with that directly, calculating things. So here I'm not calculating any low energy properties. It's not giving any insight into why it happens, confinement, what is mechanism for confinement. But it is, since it's very general, it's unlikely that you will get some particular understanding of particular models.
Do you think the Lorentz symmetry is absolutely essential for this?
Or? I think so. I think there may be even a counterexample if you have, I think, K-square kind of distortion. At least it's quoted in one of the papers I read that this may be a counterexample. And I'm pretty sure you require Lorentz symmetry. And I think.
So the Fermi surface.
I'll be very surprised if that turns out to be.
How about the
Lorentz
for the
Cartesian
symmetry or other symmetry?
This is low energy theory. As long as low energy theory has, I think generally it doesn't matter, right? And the low energy theory. The question is whether you have the rotation symmetry or not. In the UV you may not. That I think doesn't matter. It's a question of let me be more careful. If you know that your theory is low energy theory some QED3, then you can use these things. I mean, if you're not even sure of what you're expecting is, then but I should formulate a question, I think, before using this. So if you start with lattice model with square lattice, I don't even know why should it go to QED3. So I think we are done. Doesn't solve anything.
All right, so that ends our workshop.
So let's do dinner tomorrow night, right? 5:30. We'll get a chance to thank Patrick for all of his hard work. So we'll meet outside the KITT at 5:15. right before it gets dark, and walk down to the